All right, good morning, everybody. It is Thursday morning, 9 a.m., February 11th. And this morning, we are going to talk about the multi-step reaction. So hopefully you guys can all see the screen share. So you can see my iPad. And we're going to start multi-step synthesis. All right, so the multi-step synthesis, it's going to be hard for me to concentrate with music on. Come on, you're supposed to stop. There we go. All right. Good morning. The multi-step synthesis reaction is the next reaction sequence that we wind up doing. And I do this one for a number of different reasons. It is the first really big project that we wind up doing. So in this project, what we do is we take benzaldehyde as a starting material. And benzaldehyde is condensed using a catalyst called thiamine. And it's thiamine hydrochloride. So we'll dot HCl. We'll talk about what that means when we do a dot like that in an HCl. And it condenses it into a material that is called benzoin. And so it takes two of these benzaldehydes to make the benzoin. And then from benzoin, we oxidize this using nitric acid. And we oxidize that to, I'm going to tighten this up a little bit because I'm going to see if I can fit it all on one line. We oxidize that to benzyl. And then benzyl is reacted with potassium hydroxide, a fairly strong potassium hydroxide solution, and it does a base catalyzed rearrangement and it makes benzylic acid. It's called a pinacol-pinacolone rearrangement. And it makes benzylic acid. And so this usually comprises 3 weeks worth of work or more that we wind up working on this, because each one of these reactions takes sort of a week to complete as you go through the synthesis, the isolation, characterization of each one of these steps. So we've got the first step, second step, third step, and along the way, you're using benzaldehyde to make benzoin, you use your benzoin to make benzyl, and then you use your benzyl to make benzylic acid, and characterizing each one of these products as we make it. And we write a report that covers the entire synthesis. We write a report that starts from the benzaldehyde all the way to the benzylic acid, and you have an overall percent yield. And usually the percent yield overall usually comes out somewhere in the like 5% range from the starting mass of the benzaldehyde. And so you don't have very much material left over at the end when you get to the benzylic acid. And I like this reaction for a lot of different reasons. Number one, it's a big project, so we're into it for several weeks. You get to see how synthesis works and how your material decreases with each step as you're going forward. The chemistry involved in the thiamine reaction is biologically relevant and has a great mechanism and is sort of foreshadowing what's coming with carbonyl chemistry and where we're going with carbonyl chemistry. We get to look at oxidations and how oxidations work. And so talk about oxidations, which is a great intro into that component within this segment of second semester organic chemistry. And we look at some rearrangements, which are also kind of cool, and some acid-base chemistry and extraction chemistry that happens in the last step, and characterization all the way through. It's just, it has all the elements, and each one of these steps uses all of the organic laboratory skills that we've already learned. So it takes all the skills that you learn first semester and applies them directly in second semester in working through these. So it just encompasses everything that I want to do. So it's fantastic for all of those reasons. And so today what I want to focus on is I want to focus on this step today. And in writing this report, one of the main things that we do is we look at the mechanisms of each one of these reactions and discussing them in the discussion section and how these mechanisms work and why they work. And so let's pick it up with this reaction. And the reaction in Pavia, I should say, is titled multi-step synthesis. And so if you're looking for it in Pavia, and I know people have different versions of the textbook, under the different versions, if you look under multi-step synthesis in the index, you'll find this reaction of going from benzaldehyde to benzoin to benzyl to benzylic acid. Okay, so let's start off talking about thiamine hydrochloride first and this catalyst. Thiamine hydrochloride, when we do the dot, we oftentimes use a dot to indicate hydrates. So that means that water is incorporated in the structure. Here, oftentimes with an amine like thiamine, they include the dot HCl to say that this is a salt and that it's in its protonated form, but they're not telling you exactly where it's protonated. They just say that it's protonated. And oftentimes with amines, they protonate amines and sell them in their protonated form for certain types of biological amines, just because it's easier to isolate them and easier to store them as a solid and to sell them. And so thiamine has a structure that is fairly large. And what we will do is we will find a way to abbreviate this structure. It has an amine base that is an aromatic amine base reminiscent of many of the amino, not amino acids, but the nucleic acids in its structure. And then the relevant part of the molecule that we're going to be dealing with is this part, which is called a thiazole ring. I'm just making sure that I'm getting the structure correct. Okay, and here's the chloride. But then there is also another HCl that is included within this structure. And so there are two cations and two anions included in this. And it's probable that that it is one of these nitrogens that are on the aromatic ring that are protonated and an additional chloride ion that is sitting in here. And so there's two cations and two chloride anions that encompass this. And this thiamine itself, so this is just the thiamine itself. This is vitamin B. And it is a coenzyme for many biological processes. And it embeds itself within a larger protein structure. And it usually is found as thiamine pyrophosphate. And so if we take this entire structure, And on the oxygen end over here, we put a diphosphate group. This is thiamine pyrophosphate. And this is involved in all different types of catalytic cycles within the citric acid cycle, within many different enzymatic processes within the body in both bond making and bond breaking. So it is involved in many different types of catalytic processes and always included within a larger protein structure as the active coenzyme within the larger enzyme that we talk about. And what we're going to do is we're going to use the thiamine hydrochloride and we're going to abbreviate it and focus just on this part here. This part is called the thiazole ring. And it's actually the catalytic active component. And so everything else that's attached to that makes it functional in physiological systems, makes it soluble within biological systems. You have a lot of the amines here that are hydrogen bonding components and strongly polar components. You have the hydroxyl group, which allows it to be able to bond to phosphates. All of this makes it highly soluble within biological systems, but the active component is what's going on here within the thiazole ring. And so what we're going to do is we're going to take that and we're going to just abbreviate it. Set this aside. We're going to abbreviate it this way to make it easier to draw and to focus on the relevant chemistry that we need to do. We'll take and we'll put the hydroxyl group as an R prime. We'll leave the methyl alone. And we'll put an R group over here. And so this is going to be our thiazole component. Okay, everybody following along? All right, the next thing that we're going to do is we're going to take a look at how that works with this mechanism. And this is probably the longest mechanism that you've looked at to date as we go through and look at how benzaldehyde reacts with this. Our reaction, let's just put our reaction up here, that we're taking two benzaldehydes. We're reacting them with that thiazole ring. We use a 2-molar sodium hydroxide solution. It's done in water and isopropyl and ethanol, 95% ethanol. Takes about 2 days in order for the reaction to complete. And in the end, we get benzoin. And if you look at benzaldehyde, it has a structural formula, which is C7H6O. The structural formula over here of benzoin is exactly twice. It's C14H12O2. And so it is that every atom that is in here is conserved And basically what we have done is we have stitched the two together with a new bond. And that's the new bond that is stitching the benzaldehydes together. And we want to go through and we want to look at the mechanism of this reaction. So here's a tip. Whenever we start a mechanism, we look at the reaction and we say, is the reaction acid catalyzed or base catalyzed or catalyzed by some other means? If it is base catalyzed, the first step is always going to be a deprotonation. If it's acid catalyzed, the first step in the mechanism will always be a protonation. So this one is base catalyzed. We're going to look for first step deprotonation. And we're going to focus on that thiazol ring. And there's an acidic proton that is on the thiazol ring. And the challenge is to find the most acidic proton. But the hard part is that you may not be able to easily recognize, and I'm not going to draw the counterion. So I'm drawing just the positive charge on the nitrogen. The chloride is a counterion. I'm going to ignore the chloride. So everybody wants to know, where did the chloride go? It's there. We're just not focusing on it. Okay, so where are their protons? Well, there's protons that are on the methyl group. And besides that, there's only one other proton. And that's that guy. And that one is actually the most acidic proton. And the reason why is not probably entirely obvious. So our first step is pulling that proton and kicking the electrons back to the carbon. Okay, this thing, when you have a positive charge next to a negative charge, this is called a Zwitter ion, but we have another, there's two names for it. This is always my problem, is how much space do I want to take up with the additional information stuff? Let's call it an illid. Why? Illid, and it's a type of what is called a Zwitter ion. So a Zwitter ion is where you have a positive and a negative charge in the same molecule. An illid is where you have a positive charge and a negative charge adjacent to each other in the same molecule. And the illid is what makes it really stable. In addition, the sulfur can expand its octet. And so there is resonance with the sulfur that we can show, and that that we can push those electrons in towards that sulfur to make an additional bond and an expanded octet. Okay, this guy is a nucleophile. And cheat. And it's going to attack our benzaldehyde. In that the aldehyde is partial positive at the carbon base. Because of the electronegativity and the polarity difference between oxygen and carbon, the carbon is electrophilic, it's an electrophile. And the negative charge attacks that carbon, breaks the bond, and shifts the electrons up onto the oxygen. So we get a new bond here that is bonded to the hydrogen, the O minus, and the aromatic ring system. I'm used to working this problem on a whiteboard. This is the first time I've ever tried to do it on an iPad. When I'm trying to keep everything lined up so the notes look good later. All right, that'll work. I just needed enough room to fit in my aromatic ring system. Okay. The next step in this is that we have deprotonated this guy over here. When we did that, we now have a proton source within the solution. I'm just going to characterize B as a general base. Our next step is to take the proton back and protonate the O minus. And then we have a deprotonation. So they oftentimes go protonation, deprotonation, protonation, deprotonation. They happen quite frequently like that. So the base pulls the proton, and we're pulling this proton because of its acidity. By virtue of when we pull this guy, the electrons push into the bond there. These electrons push up onto the nitrogen and they alleviate the positive charge. And so we can think of this as a series of resonance structures with the most stable resonance contributor having a nitrogen which is now neutral. So we have a double bond. The nitrogen now has a lone pair. And we're at this structure. Now this structure is an important structure and it has two important functional groups that I need to talk about for a second. Actually, maybe you could tell me, do you see any functional groups that you recognize in this molecule? What do you see?
Alcohol.
There's an alcohol. Good. What else?
Amine.
There's an amine.
Phenol.
What is it?
A phenol ring.
The phenol ring. Yeah. Yep, the aromatic ring system. Okay, watch this. Let me turn this down a bit so it's not so big. What is that functional group?
An enol.
JC, it's an enol. It is. There's an enol in this. And besides the enol, there is also this functional group, which is related to an enol. And we didn't talk about that functional group. But if we look at the two functional groups, one of them being this one, an enol, and the other one being this one, we'll put two R groups on it with the lone pairs. This one, This was an ene for the double bond and the al, the alcohol. This one is an amine. So we have an ene, the way that we name it, ene, and then amine. This is an enamine. Okay, and so the way in which enols worked, if we remember the tautomerization reaction, the tautomerization reaction used the lone pairs on the alcohol to push in and to push out, and we would get a negative charge out of the terminal end, which would then grab a proton. The nitrogen does the same thing. It puts a force on the double bond, pushing them out to make a lone pair at the end, which can then be a nucleophile. So this molecule is a nucleophile. Now, which one of the lone pairs, the oxygen or the nitrogen, exerts a larger pressure? Which element is more willing to donate its electrons, oxygen or nitrogen?
Nitrogen.
Nitrogen, because nitrogen is less electronegative, and because it's less electronegative, it's more willing to donate its lone pair. And so, yes, that is the pair that winds up being donated. Now, I'm going to change colors for my next benzaldehyde. And I'm going to draw a benzaldehyde here. Because we're going to attack the next benzaldehyde, again, at the position that is here, because that position is partial positive at the base of the carbonyl. And so what we're going to do is we're going to push that lone pair back in. We're going to take this pair of electrons and make a new carbon-carbon bond. We're going to break the carbonyl, and those electrons are going to go back to the oxygen. Let's see if that will fit. I believe it will. Into this spot. So we've remade that bond. The nitrogen now has a positive charge again. We now have a single bond that has the hydroxyl group and the aromatic ring system on it. We now have a new bond that we have made, and that new bond is connecting us to both the hydrogen, the O minus, and the aromatic ring system on the new benzaldehyde. And that's where we're at. Once we get to this point, we have another protonation step. So that catalytic function of the acid in the base, we reprotonate the O minus. So we'll draw that much again. And interestingly, this is much of how this molecule functions in a biological system. And in fact, all of this chemistry is taking place in 95% ethanol, just for solubility reasons for our benzaldehyde. But notice that all of these cations and anions are happening within an aqueous system. And that's our biological chemistry that is taking place in a biological system in an aqueous environment. And so this is how we make carbon-carbon bonds in the presence of water, where we cannot do this with Grignard chemistry or with the alkynyl anion chemistry. So this type of enolate chemistry is specific to aqueous or I shouldn't say specific, but is capable of being done in an aqueous environment, which is really cool. Okay, we're almost done. This is our last step that we've got to do here. And I think what I need to do is give this proton just a little bit more space, because we're about to pull that proton. So our base is going to come in now and is going to pull the proton attached to the first oxygen. Those electrons push in, that clips the bond and returns the electrons to the thiazol ring and completes our catalytic activity and reinitiates the cycle. So what winds up happening now is we get our thiazol ring. We get our molecule that now has a carbonyl in it. We have the new bond. That new bond goes to the hydrogen, the alcohol, and the aromatic ring from the second benzaldehyde. The first one I forgot my double bonds on. And we have regenerated this acid catalyst that we've been using as we go through. And so this entire system, once the thiazol ring detaches, this piece is catalytic. It can go back and it can redo this job over and over and over again, thousands and millions of times. And we've ended up with our benzoin. So just to go back and look at these steps real quick and put names to these steps, because it's really helpful to have names to these catalytic steps. Our first step that we're doing here is deprotonation. The next step that we have is nucleophilic attack. We have a protonation. Followed by a deprotonation. Another nucleophilic attack. Deprotonation. With loss of leaving group. And then we're back to our catalytic cycle. So those are all the steps in that mechanism. And the trick is understanding and explaining and finding the language to explain each one of the steps. And it's hard to get all of those things down in words. We may have to go back and we may have to watch that process of writing out the mechanism again and the language that is used. But really it's when we pull the proton here, this is the most acidic proton because of the negative charge and the formation of the ILID. And the ILID here helps to stabilize that negative charge, which is why it's so stable in the first place. Even though it's stable, it's still a good nucleophile as a negative charge. And so that nucleophile attacks an electrophile in solution, which is our benzaldehyde. The alkoxide ion gets protonated and pulls a proton from somewhere in solution. one of the conjugate bases then deprotonates. This proton is acidic by virtue of the fact of the ability to relieve the positive charge on the nitrogen and the amount of resonance that's created when we pull that proton. This system and the enol and the enamine that are created while being stable and allowing for that when we pull the proton is still a strong nucleophile. And that nucleophile reacts as a carbon nucleophile rather than a nitrogen nucleophile. It attacks another benzaldehyde, which opens up to give the alkoxide ion. The alkoxide ion then is protonated because it's the strongest base. We then find an acidic proton again, and there are many, but when the base finds this proton, it does so with loss of leaving group, returning the stable imide, which can then go back and do its catalytic cycle. Okay, JC, there's another protonation after the second nucleophilic attack, right? Yes, I missed that one, thank you. Protonation right here. Good eyes, Jason. I had missed one. And what else do I need to say about this? Ah, I know. When we deprotonate and protonate, there are many different oxygens which can be protonated or deprotonated. Each one of these steps can be considered to be a reversible step. The only step that is not easily reversible is when we create the carbonyl here and the disconnection, the loss of the leaving group of the benzoin, that is not so reversible. And as the benzoin builds up, it precipitates out of the solution, it crystallizes, and it becomes a solid. And in becoming a solid by the Chatelier's principle, once it's removed from the solution, the reaction mechanism goes forward. And so, in part, it's driven by Le Chatelier's principle and the precipitation of the benzoin. But each one of these steps can be considered to be reversible. And so if it were to protonate in a different location or deprotonate in a different location, those steps are reversible. It would just go right back to the previous starting material and then eventually goes forward through the mechanism until it actually forms benzoin.
Is that why it takes 2 days?
It takes 2 days just because it's a slow reaction and a lot of reversibility that goes on within this and the slow accumulation of the benzoin in order to build up enough to precipitate out. And once it starts to precipitate out, then the reaction starts to accelerate a little bit when the concentration gets high enough to precipitate. If it doesn't precipitate, sometimes the reaction struggles. And what we can do is sometimes offer it a seed crystal to initiate precipitation. And then once it goes, it goes pretty quickly from there. But yeah, so right now I went and I ran this reaction yesterday in lab and it's sitting in lab for 2 days now. And I have a camera on it. I'm using my old cell phone to do a time lapse over the 2 days, which I've never done. So I'm hoping that this one crystallizes and that we can get a slow time lapse over 2 days to see how this reaction actually proceeds. And so rather than sticking it in a locker, I stuck it in a fume hood with a light on in the fume hood so that we can actually film it over the 2 days and see what happens. So fingers crossed that this actually works out.
I hope you have a charger on that phone.
I do, yes. That phone, the battery is almost toast. And so that battery would last maybe 10 minutes if I were trying to film without plugging it in. So yeah, it's plugged in and doing its thing. Kind of cool.
So this is a clear solution that's going to crystallize, and that's how you see it taking place?
Let me see if I can stop this screen share and screen share. Where is it? Hiding. I'll just do desktop 2. And under desktop 2, I think it's still sharing. Hang on a second. Yeah, it's still sharing sound.
Okay, that is it for this synthesis. This is a really short, easy little synthesis in order to do. We have the benzaldehyde now in our 95% ethanol aqueous solution with base, thiamine hydrochloride. The thiamine hydrochloride is going to catalyze the condensation of the benzaldehyde to form benzoin. And we're just going to let it go for a couple of days. So we're going to put a good label on this that indicates what the chemical reaction is. I'm going to set it up in the fume hood for a couple of days. And I think I'm going to try and see if we can get a time lapse over those couple of days. We'll see how that goes. Fingers crossed that that actually works out.
All right. So that's, that's what it looks like. It is just basically sort of an off yellow color or a light yellow color. And I zoomed in the camera pretty tight to try to see if we can see that crystallization as it takes place. And we'll see what happens. So yeah, that's where we're at. All right, back to screen share. So in terms of setting this up and running the reaction, it's pretty simple. Basically, what we do is we weigh out 0.30 grams of thiamine hydrochloride. And place into a 25 mil Erlenmeyer flask. We add 0.45 milliliters of DI water and swirl to dissolve. Swirl, swirl. Add 3 milliliters of 95% ethanol. Add 0.9 milliliters of 2 molar sodium hydroxide. When you add this, the reaction turns bright yellow. And fades with time. To just sort of a dull yellow. That bright yellow is pretty cool when it turns a bright yellow color. Then what you do is you tear the flask. You add 0.9 milliliters benzaldehyde. And then reweigh the flask to get the mass of the benzaldehyde. And that's it. And then you let it sit for 2 days. And then if we don't get crystals after 2 days, there's a couple of things. Thank you, Swirl. That helps. Thanks, Keen. As I'm looking up at the comments here, really cool. I'm trying to make good videos for you guys. I'm going to put some cutouts from this next video sequence that I do. I'm going to do some outtakes because I have several times where I'm like doing it. And I'm like, why is this so difficult? As I'm trying to get the words out and videotape and do all the things and manipulations. And every once in a while, I get totally tongue-tied in a way that I don't usually do in front of students. And yet when you're trying to do it for the camera and you're wanting it to be perfect and you're like, why did I say that? That's not right. Scratch that. Hold on, back up. And you start talking to yourself because you're the only person in lab and the camera's still rolling. And it's just hysterical. So maybe we'll do some outtakes. There are some things that we can do that can initiate crystallization and help the reaction. One of the things that we are worried about or concerned about, though, is the benzaldehyde. Benzaldehyde is a very reactive molecule. It auto-oxidizes. The partial positive on this is so strong that in air, in moist air, there's an auto-oxidation process that happens where benzaldehyde converts into benzoic acid. And this is just auto-oxidation. It just happens. And benzaldehyde is a molecule, a material that smells of almonds. It is a light yellow. Almond smelling material. And benzoic acid is a solid. And so that solid, when you see it inside the benzaldehyde, you know that it's contaminated. Benzaldehyde that has any age to it will have some carboxylic acid in it. And the carboxylic acid can inhibit this reaction that we're trying to do. And so it's important to use either fresh benzaldehyde that has been bought recently, or to purify the benzaldehyde to remove any benzoic acid contamination out of the benzaldehyde before you proceed with this reaction. And that can prohibit the recrystallization. So sometimes this gets in the way if the benzaldehyde is slightly older and we didn't take steps to actually get rid of it. But if we don't have crystals after 2 days, we try to induce crystallization. We either try to scratch using a scratching rod that creates little glass shards, nucleation sites for crystallization. That can help kick it off. Or sometimes we'll borrow a seed crystal from somebody who had a successful recrystallization. We'll drop that in and that will kick off the recrystallization. And then we go through and we do the workup part. And the workup is really pretty easy too. For the workup for this, we simply ice it for 10 minutes, filter on Hirsch funnel, and rinse with approximately 1 milliliter of 0 degrees C, 95% ethanol. Then we recrystallize from 95% ethanol. At that point, we'll take the melting point. Actually, let's do it in this order. We'll get a good mass, which will give us our percent yield. We'll get a melting point, and we do an FTIR before moving on to the next step so that we characterize the product and know what we've got before we move on. So the workup part is really pretty easy, and the first reaction is really pretty easy. It's the second reaction where things take longer and are more interesting and get a little bit more involved. Okay, so with this reaction, what I do is is I have a couple of resources online for you. Under the lab materials in chemed.study, chem12bl, there is a document here underneath formal report guidelines, which is the multi-step synthesis of benzoic acid. And in here, it has all the components that you're going to need and keep track of for your formal report. So the formal report will have its title, it'll have the byline, which is your name and Cabrillo College, it'll have the abstract, percent yield for each step, melting point for each product, percent yield for overall three steps, and a statement that the FTIR analysis was conducted, but you don't have to give me a whole lot of data here, otherwise that makes the abstract way too big. So just that FTIR analysis was conducted and consistent with literature values. The introduction will be the importance of carbon-carbon bond-forming reactions, the condensation of benzaldehyde utilizing thiamine. We don't have to dwell on the biological component. That's secondary to the synthesis that we're doing. And then you have your non-technical overview, including the three main reactions carried out. Your experimental will have the standard acknowledgments of all the chemicals and equipment used. It'll have any modifications to the procedures, if you modified anything, characterization of each product, and then that last little statement that has the percent yield, its millimoles, the grams that you recovered, your melting point, and your FTIR specific wavelengths that are important. Your results will have two tables that you have the first product and the second product characterizations and statements in paragraph format. The discussion, I'll give you hints on the discussion on where to go on the discussion and specifically a mechanism for the oxidation because that's not given in the textbook. And then in that discussion, you're doing any experimental issues and your characterization of each one of the products, your conclusion, and then your references, your separation schemes and copies of the laboratory notebooks. And so this whole thing here is sort of a guide to help you to make sure that you get all the components for the formal report. So that's up there online for you already. But we'll come back and we'll talk about that when we do a wrap up to this whole experiment. So basically what I see is this experiment taking a couple of lecture periods in order to go through each one of the mechanisms and talk about each one of the experiments. I'll get the videos up online as I'm processing those videos and putting them together so that you guys can then go and watch them and take all the lab notes, just the way that we did for the Grignard. It'll just be a bigger experiment that we're kind of dealing with. So again, I have the overall picture of where it is that we're going with this one. All right.
Hey, Jason.
Yeah,
question. Can I ask a quick question in regards to lab reports? When I was in Chem 1B, I had Peter Neems, and we were writing a bunch of lab, like full lab reports. And he said for procedures and materials, pretty much what he had us do is if we had already taken notes and written it all down in our lab notebooks, just to refer to those pages in our lab notebook. If there was like an exception or we changed up something, we would duly note that, but he just said it was okay to for us to refer back to the pages. And since we're attaching these pages with like a PDF file, would that be okay? Or do you want us to go through step-by-step and the materials we use?
Peter is an outstanding instructor. Peter is one of my, he's old school. He's one of my favorite instructors. He's extremely knowledgeable. He knows exactly what he's doing and what he wants to teach. And he's consistent, as consistent can be. And he teaches really good skill sets. So kudos, Peter is fantastic. I think that what I want to try to do is I want to try to teach you how to write up an article in the way that is like an initial step to doing a formal publication, like if you were going to send it to publication, and how you would write that up different than the way that you would write it up in your laboratory notebook. So yes, in the procedure, and because the procedure is given to us in PAVIA, I would say that for the procedure, unless you modify it, you can use the phrase that says the procedure in the laboratory notebook was followed without modification, or the procedure in PAVIA was followed without modification. Or you could say, if you modified it, the procedure in Pavia was followed with the following modifications, and list out any modifications that were done. For the reagents and that characterization, I'd like that characterization line to be in there, because I want you to learn how to write out that characterization line that has the yield, the grams, the millimoles, the percent, and then has the melting point, and then the IR stuff that comes after that. So I'd like to see that part. I think that's worth writing out.
Is that referring to the materials session?
Two questions coming on top of each other. Oh. So let me take you back to where that is and show you what that looks like. And then I'll hit the IR stuff and we can talk about that too. And this is a perfect thing to deal with as you guys are finalizing and finishing out writing that formal report. Let's hit that. Let me go back to screen share. Use my second desktop because we're already here. Let's move this out of the way and maximize this so you guys can really see what we're doing. And then in the formal report guidelines, of which that's hard to read, PDF is easier. That's bigger. They're the same. This was an example all the way through to here of the Grignard. And then I have some things that are thrown in that are not Grignard in terms of the materials that we used. So up until this point where we get to the end of the thermometer, those are the materials that you used and the equipment that you used. Oh, except I take that back. We go through the infrared spectrophotometer there. The procedure, this is the exact procedure in the way that I'm trying to teach you to write out a procedure. That this is the exact procedure for the Grignard. And at the bottom of this is that statement that I'd like to see, which is how much your yield is, how many grams, how many millimoles, what percent that is. This is a standard way that most of the journals at the end of their procedure list the outcome of the product. And the X's here are whatever you want them to be that are important wavelengths. And so we can go back and I can show you the Grignard. Let me find it. I hit it. In here, in my stills. I'm going to put this into the notes. Interesting. That did not go where it was supposed to go. Sorry, I'm doing a bunch of juggling here to get the file where I want it. Let me bring you back into the iPad for a second. When we look at the important IR wavelengths, these are basically what you want them to be, and you can list as many or as few as you like. But what we typically try to do is we typically try to list out the wavelengths that determine the functional groups that we're interested in and the major wavelengths that can be easily distinguished for this material that somebody who looking at the spectrum would be able to find and read quickly. This one, because it's the hydroxyl group, is really important. And so we would list the 3464 as a broad peak. And then we might list over on the other side, sort of the major peaks. I would pick the 1445. I would pick the 1010, the 758. The next one isn't labeled. For some reason, the label dropped off and I missed it. And maybe we would pick the 1229 because that's isolated in the middle. That's a little bit easier to see. Maybe the 1156 and then call it good and not have to do all the rest. So you're just kind of picking a threshold that is major peaks and peaks that are important for functional groups. The carbon hydrogen stretch, everything's going to have that. And so we don't list the carbon hydrogen stretches. We don't worry about the small peaks unless they correspond to a specific functional group that we're looking for. And so it's those major ones that I'm looking for. Ooh, Keegan, I missed. What do I mean by tear the flask? That goes back to watching the video where after I add everything into the flask, before I add the benzaldehyde, I weigh the flask. Tearing is weighing. It is a pre-weight so that when you add material into the flask and then weigh it a second time, you can find the mass of the material that you add by the difference between the two. So a tear weight is not a direct weight. It is a pre-weighing to subtract from the second weighing. That's what we mean by a tear weight. Okay. All right, did I hit the IR wavelength question now? Good enough?
Mostly, I just had, I guess, follow-ups from that. So with the little list that you gave us, we just list those in that, what the methods and materials, but then would we hit and discuss every one of those points when we're talking about like what we got in our discussion?
No.
As well? No, okay.
When you mean these points, you mean these wavelengths?
Yes, sorry.
Right, no. No, you do not need to discuss all of these wavelengths. What I would do, if I were writing this, what I would do is let me go pull another spectrum and show how I would structure this. This will take me just a second because I got to go get, what did we start with? We started with benzophenone. So I need to go to and spectroscopy database. I'm gonna go get benzophenone. And so this will take me a second. Bear with me. Let's see how fast I can do this. I want the IR. I want to make sure that it is the KBR because they got a billion IRs. Looks like it is. Open the image in a new tab. File print. Open in preview. And airdrop it in. Okay, so here is benzophenone. And what we basically have in benzophenone that is the really distinguishing characteristic of benzophenone is the carbonyl. And that carbonyl is here. And that wavelength is the 17, 1666 wavelength. And I found that because I know that this is the strongest wavelength that has the smallest percent transmission. And so I'm down here around 6% in that transmission. And so when I was fishing through the numbers here, I'm looking at 84%, 84%, 74%, there's my six. That's how I picked that out. And if we go into our spectrum up here, that is our benzaldehyde spectrum, what we see, if we go to 1666, we're somewhere in here. And there is no 1666. So we have the loss of the 1666. And this peak here is new. And so it is the loss of the 1666 reciprocal centimeter peak, which means that we're really not seeing any of the starting material. We're not seeing any of that benzophenone in my, is my screen, are you guys able to see what I'm doing? Just checking my screen, looks like it was frozen. Okay, cool. On my end, things got a little wonky. You have that loss of the 1666, the loss of the carbonyl. And that loss of that carbonyl is really due to the chemical reaction that we did, that we had the Grignard. Coming in as an anion and attacking benzophenone and converting it into the triphenylmethanol. And so that's exactly what we expect to see, is we hope that we don't see any of the 1666 peak, because that would indicate that our reaction did not go successfully if that were still present. And then this is 3464. Does that help? That's the main thing you need to discuss. You don't need to discuss all of the other peaks.
Okay, cool. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, what else can I help you guys with? Any other questions that come up while writing this or looking at this report? So I feel like about it. Do we include the benzophenone FTIR in the report? You can, it can be helpful. It can be part of your discussion section, or it can just be included as an image that you reference within the discussion component. If you're gonna be talking about it and you're talking about that wavelength that is specific to benzophenone, you can grab it off of the Japan spectroscopy database. And you can give them reference for using their material as one of your references in your report. I don't know.
Are we?
Go ahead.
Are we referencing like in-text citation wise, or are we just sticking all of our sources at the end?
I sort of allow you to do either or. So you can do footnotes where the reference happens on the same page that the reference occurs, or you can do them as endnotes that happen at the end of the document, and you can do it either way.
Okay, but you're like, you want those little superscript numbers? Yes. Or something? Okay.
Yes. So again, if we go back to chemed.study, now I've got a bunch of pages here now open, share, desktop two. And you look at those formal report guidelines. And this time I'll go to the HTML because it's a little bit easier. What I've got here is on the references, it shows how I like to see them with the superscript. And that goes at the sentence. It can either go mid-sentence where the reference happens, or it can go at the end of the sentence following the period. Both are acceptable. And then at the bottom of the page or at the end of the document, depending upon how you want to do it, you have them numbered out corresponding to the footnote where you used it, and then the reference listed.
Okay, and then because we kind of took that sample methods and materials thing you did, would we cite you in that case, even though we changed the numbers?
No, I let that go.
Okay.
Good question. Let that go. Just use it. Just be careful not to grab the NMR components. Don't copy it verbatim. Watch that you don't grab all of that NMR stuff. I should just go in and delete that. That would make it a whole lot easier. Then I wouldn't have to complain when people just copy it. Oh, and double checking on the hand drawing. Yes, you are hand drawing structures. So don't try to use any computer sort of drawing. It just gets too difficult. It's too complicated. It's easier if you just hand draw those things in. Okay, anything else?
Just like a general kind of thing, if you start the sentence with approximately like 5 milligrams, you can just write 5 as a number. It doesn't have to be like spelled out.
If you put the word approximately before the 5 milligrams, then it can, usually if it's a number below 10, we generally write it out in words. But if it's a measurement like that, and you have a word in front of the actual measurement that's being taken, then you can write the measurement. But if it's going to be 5 milligrams that you're starting the sentence with, then you would write out 5 as a word, as opposed to just dropping in a number at the beginning of a sentence.
Okay, that's what I thought. Thank you.
You're welcome. And if you look at the both the report that I put up from Nicole, and you look at my report as well, I think you'll see, I think I'm still screen sharing over here where it says 15 milligrams of magnesium. I was trying to model that way of when I start with a number, how do I do that? And I write it out in words when I'm starting with a number. But there are ways to construct your sentence that don't require you to do that. But that's commonly the way that it's done.
The 15 milligrams part is just an example, right?
You actually used 15 milligrams roughly. We had a specific amount that we weighed out. I can't remember what it was now, but the measurement from the lab itself would replace this measurement in the procedure. So the procedure should have your specific measurements and your specific millimoles and numbers that go into this.
The whole paragraph?
Yes.
Okay.
And Kelly wants to know, could we go over the modifications to Pavia for this one? The only modifications to Pavia that I'm aware of was that we used a sand bath instead of a water bath. That Pavia, and I'll show why, Pavia had asked us to use a water bath in the Grignard reaction. So Pavia had instructed us to set things up this way. They wanted the air condenser and then the round bottom. And this whole thing, they wanted set in a beaker. And that all got set onto the hot plate. Okay, and they would have done it that way. And my concern with this, or did they want that? Am I thinking about a different reaction? Let me think through this. I need to go back and reread the Pavia one now. It's been so long since I reread it because I just know the way that I do it all the time. I think Pavia wanted a water bath on this. And my concern with that is that any water vapor could enter into my reaction. And so I just nixed the water bath and I just do it on the hot plate. I think that's the only modification. There wasn't any other modification that I did in terms of this reaction. Everything else was consistent with Pavia.
You said no water bath, but did you say sand bath?
I was thinking that, and I didn't do it in this one. Sometimes what I have the students do is take and use a sand bath where this is sand that we place in here. And we use an aluminum foil cup that we construct. And then we fill it with sand around it and we heat the sand rather than heating water. And the reason that Pavia uses water in most of their, in many of their reactions is because the water is easy to heat and easy to maintain in its temperature. And it's what most people have available. My concern with a water bath that is constructed like this is that yes, while it's easy to construct, oftentimes water can enter into your chemical reaction, which you don't want. And I just, it's not my favorite. It allows you to only get to 100 degrees. And then by the time you get to 100 degrees, you're boiling the water and then you're dealing with boiling water as you're heating things. And it's just not very convenient for anything over 100 degrees. When you use sand like this, the sand we can heat well over 200 degrees if we wanted to. And for many chemical reactions, it is oftentimes easier to handle and manage and heat. And we use a thermometer in it in exactly the same way that we would use with a water bath. We stick a thermometer down into the sand and we monitor the temperature and we can get pretty precise control. And so I teach students to use sand baths. The only other thing, there's two other ways of heating. One other way of heating is using what's called a heating mantle. They're oftentimes constructed out of a non-flammable material. This thing plugs into some sort of controller called a rheostat, and then this plugs into the wall. You can dial it in. This is called a heating mantle. And they're constructed for round bottom flasks. There are different sizes of the heating mantles depending upon the size of the flask that you're trying to use. And the flask sits inside of that and it heats around the outside of the flask. Oftentimes we call this a bird's nest, is another way of referring to it. The last way that people heat things is with an oil bath. And this is one of my least favorite. And the only reason that it's my least favorite is that I've seen too many accidents. So in an oil bath, we put oil down in here, and the oil can be heated in upwards of 200 degrees. So they have like a 200 degree C limit, whereas water has a 100 degree C limit. So the water's too limited. The sand essentially has no real limit to it. The heating mantle likewise can go easily up to 200 degrees. So we can go greater than 200 degrees if we need to with the heating mantle. The problem with the oil is that oftentimes when we do these high heat reactions, we use a condenser. And the condenser oftentimes has water attached to it. And so water comes in and water comes out. And it's a double-walled vessel such that the water circulates in the inner wall. And the chemicals are held inside the other piece. And they are allowed to reflux and then hit the cold water and then condense. The problem with this is that the tubing that comes off of this, and you're using cold water, sometimes condensation will form on this and drip, and you'll get drips that hit into the oil. Ever seen what happens when water hits hot oil on a stove? You can even just think of it like you have a hot frying pan with some oil in it, and you're just throwing in those vegetables, and it just explodes. When the water drops hit this oil, they cause the oil to explode out. The oil hits the hot hot plate that's heating the whole thing, catches fire, and the entire thing goes up. I have seen 3 fume hoods go up in flames where we've had to evacuate the building, where the building almost was taken down because a student improperly set this up with a sand bath. I mean, with an oil bath that was too hot, and the whole thing catches fire. So they like to use the oil because it surrounds the flask so evenly and heats so evenly that it's really nice in that regard, but it's a super fire hazard. And so my favorite are either the heating mantle, which is expensive, or the sand bath, which is cheap. Water, if you're under 100 degrees and not doing an air sensitive reaction, and never oil, unless it's like last resort and you're not heating too high. If you're doing something like 60 degrees, then oil's fine. But it's also messy. It just gets all over everything. And anyway, you guys got me on a tangent. That's my thought process on different ways of heating solutions, heating reactions. All right, so I want to alleviate some anxiety over this formal report too. That as we're going into this formal report, that I know that you guys haven't had a lot of experience. Some of you who came out of Peter's class, yes. Some of you who may have come out of Albie's class and Zaruba's class, particularly with the reports, didn't write reports last semester. And so you may be out of practice and feeling a lot of anxiety over this. There's only 20 points on this formal report. And I'm thinking of this kind of as a rough draft. And it may even come back to you to do some edits on it after I review it and look at it. So don't feel a whole lot of anxiety over this first one. We have more pressure on the second one. We're using this one as a means to sort of hone our skills and get ready for the second one, which is a bigger report. Okay, so don't get too caught up in it. And in all likelihood, it'll probably come back to you with some requested edits for you to fix before I put a grade on it. Okay.
Thank you. That would be awesome.
Good. That alleviates the anxiety of, can you look at it before you grade it? And the answer is, I am going to look at it before I grade it. And I may ask you to change some things before I grade it. So don't stress. Okay. Give me your best shot and then let me do my work. And then I'll tell you what needs to be done to fix it. All right, sound good? That's all I had. If you guys want to stick around and continue asking questions, I'm more than happy to do that. If you want to use the remaining time to deal with some lecture questions and deal with it like office hours, I'm also open to that. I think what I'll do though is I'll stop the recording here because we've dealt with all the lab stuff and then just treat it sort of like open office hours for the rest of the time that we've got. And anybody who wants to log off is welcome to go. Okay, sound like a plan?
Yep.
All right, let's do that. So we'll end the recording here.
Thanks, Jason.
You're welcome.